Welcome to Slaking Thirsts, a podcast that's all about bringing the thirst deep within our hearts for love and communion to the heart of Christ, a divine heart, who is seeking our love and communion in return. The hope is that the two thirsts would meet and both thirsts would be slaked.
Friends, good evening.
Good evening.
It's so good to be with you. I've been looking forward to this event. Tanis, I don't remember when you invited me, but I'm honored to be back. You know, it's fun when you get to go to events like this as a priest. You're preaching to people who are like, these are people who get it. And it's just wonderful. The hospitality is great. We were standing in the back there before Mass started, and like the cheese was wafting. It's like, it's all the good foods. And I knew the music was going to be good, but I wasn't expecting like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. You guys, I don't know, however much they're paying you, I'll pay you more, yeah, to come sing for me. So anyway.
Over half of them are mine.
Okay, bidding war. Bidding war. Talk to me afterwards. Okay. Well, again, it's just great to be with you. It's been a fun full day for me. Earlier this morning, I was down in Columbus at Damascus. I don't know if any of your kids have been to Damascus for Catholic Youth Summer Camp or any of you for men's retreats or women's retreats. But just like, who's been down there for anything? Well, that's cool. That's awesome. Okay, yeah, I was down there this morning for their women's retreat, their spring women's retreat. There's 250 ladies there. Again, just a great audience to be preaching to as a priest. It's one of my favorite kind of settings, especially. Like, you say something meaningful, and they all go, and that's just like, that's really nice, you know? So if you want to make any of those noises while I'm talking, that's cool too. The guys don't really do that on the guys' retreats. There's no, that just gets weird. So anyway, it's fun to see some familiar faces. It sounds like it's been a great day, and it's been a few years since I've been back at Marriages of Grace. I think the last time, I was giving a talk and the fire alarms went off in the middle of my talk. That was, I don't know, I might happen again. I don't know. I'm feeling kind of on fire already. So, all right. So something that I'm very acutely aware of, and so is Father Barry, but something that I'm very acutely aware of in this context is that all of you, obviously, you're here because you're married, and I'm not married, at least in the same way that you are, right? I wear a wedding band. You wear a wedding band? Yeah, we wear wedding bands. I'm just thinking about this earlier this morning. I was thinking about and praying about the complementarity of our vocations. They're like, I need you. We need you. We need faithful lay couples to constantly remind us as celibates that we're not ordained bachelors, that we are meant to live a spousal paternal relationship to the bride. And you need us to be constantly reminded that marriage is not the be all end all. Not that you probably need the reminder all the time. You're like, I'm sitting next to my reminder, right? But you need to be reminded often, right, that the person you're married to, the vocation you entered into, was only ever meant to be a small appetizer and a foretaste of the glory yet to come, right? The spouse that you are sitting with, the spouse that the Lord brought into your life, was only ever meant to awaken an ache for the greater, ever greater, infinite fulfillment that is heaven, right? Heaven is the marriage supper of the Lamb. That's where this is all headed. It's not just a big room where God happens to live that we'll also happen to live. No, it's union with the triune God, which is extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. Your spouse was only ever meant to awaken an ache that won't be satisfied in this life. And you need us to remind you of that. You need us to remind you of that. Like, the paradox of the life of the priest is that the life that God has called us away from, namely, like, spouse and children, family life, that's meant to become, it must become the life that rivets the priest's imagination. The life that we're called away from has to become, is meant to become the life that rivets our imagination, that captivates us. And friends, I'm captivated by marriage. I love marriage. Like I feel what the young Carol Wojtyła felt when he said, I fell in love with love. I fell in love with love. I love marriage and I love my married friends. I love working and walking with married couples. I love marriage prep. I love celebrating weddings. I love all of it. You know, it's like I love marriage so much that I had to lay it upon the altar of sacrifice so that I could receive every marriage and be at the service of every marriage. Like, that's how much I love it. So this weekend, friends, this weekend, the church on the fourth Sunday of Easter celebrates Good Shepherd Sunday. Maybe you picked up on that with the gospel that we have, right? Jesus in John chapter 10 telling us, I am the good shepherd. So this gospel, though, the gospel from John, it begins, obviously, chapter 10. It begins at verse 11. Now, no one asked me my opinion on this. But if they had, I would have said, back it up to verse 10. Don't start at verse 11. I would have said, start at verse John chapter 10, starting at verse 10. Because I think that verse is the verse that we need to understand everything that comes after that. Right? So John chapter 10, verse 10, Jesus says, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. And then he goes into the Good Shepherd discourse. That the whole Good Shepherd discourse is framed by, set up first by Jesus saying, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. He's telling us who he is. He's telling us his desires. He's telling us, this is who I am. This is the heart of your God. And it's so important because if we don't have that in mind, we're going to always operate out of a paradigm of rivalry, of competitiveness. We'll always buy into the lie that we were first sold in the garden. Right? The enemy approaches Eve not because she's weak. He approaches her because she's receptive, because she's the archetype of humanity, because she's the crown jewel of the whole story. He approaches her and he whispers a seductive question that's not inviting her to, like, atheism. That's stupid. He knows that's not going to happen. He's suggesting to her that perhaps God isn't who you think he is. Perhaps he's not this good and loving and doting father who only wants your good. Perhaps he's an enemy. Perhaps he's actually holding out on you. That there's a fruit in this garden that if you eat it, you'll have something that you don't currently have. So the question that the enemy whispers, it arises this doubt which gives birth to fear, which gives birth to grasping. And so she grasps at the fruit because she thinks, I'm now in this competitive relationship to God. More God, less humanity. I have to protect myself from God. And this is the lie that we've all been touched with. And yes, we've been like healed of original sin through our baptism, but it is a pernicious lie that's deep in the human heart, deep in the human soul, that we are easily susceptible to in this fallen world. It's easy. Like, if the enemy could get Adam and Eve to believe that lie in Eden, that God's not good, how much easier is it for him to believe, get us to believe that lie in this fallen world where there's suffering and brokenness and pain? Jesus starts off this gospel by saying, I came that you might have life. I'm for you. I'm not against you. I am for you. I want your flourishing. I want your joy. I'm the God of superabundance. I don't ration out my gifts. I don't ration out life. Like when Jesus goes fishing, he catches so much fish that he sinks boats. When he makes bread, he makes so much bread that there's 15,000 people fed and 12 wicker baskets left over. When he makes wine, he makes 180 gallons of the best wine that anybody's had. He's not a God of drips and crumbs. He's a God of superabundance. He's the God of the banquet. That was awesome. Are you guys converts? That was great. All right, so let's go back to Jesus. I am the good shepherd. He says, I am the good shepherd. Pause there. And immediately when we hear that, I am the good shepherd, immediately coming to our minds often is probably a lot of bad artwork. Let's just start with that. A lot of bad artwork. Where Jesus looks awfully effeminate. Jesus is, you know, he's got the sheep and the things. It's like, okay, all right. I've seen that in every Italian grandma's house. Okay, I get it. Here's something fascinating. If you've ever been to Rome, if you've ever gone into the catacombs, one of the things you would probably have learned is that this is the first image that the early church used to depict the Lord. This beardless young shepherd with the sheep hung over his shoulders. I am the good shepherd. I am the good shepherd. He says this. A good shepherd, let's pause there, because he's about to describe what a good shepherd does. And it's important that we pause, because so often as Catholics, we just fill in the blanks. We know what comes next. We just go with what we already know. Let me just switch up the image to defamiliarize us with this. A good dairy farmer. Okay, a good dairy farmer. What is a good dairy farmer? A good dairy farmer has lots of cows, produces and harvests a lot of milk. gets a lot of milk from the cows. If you don't do that, if you're a dairy farmer, you're a bad dairy farmer, right? A good chicken farmer, is that a thing? Is that what they're called? I'm calling that. Okay, good chicken farmer. Good chicken farmer. What do? They've got a lot of chickens. Chickens produce a lot of eggs. If you don't have a lot of chickens producing a lot of eggs, you're a bad chicken farmer. Is there another name for that? Poultry dude? I don't know. All right. A good beekeeper has a lot of hives, harvests a lot of honey from the hives, right? Back to Jesus. If we take the Christian lens off that we all just know, we would fill in the blank, right? A good shepherd does what? Has a big growing herd, collects a lot of wool, sells a lot of livestock. That's what a good shepherd, a successful shepherd, a good shepherd, that's how we would describe them, right? If we took the Christian lens off and just heard it with a naivete. So in other words, right, a shepherd uses the sheep to get life and livelihood for himself. A good, successful shepherd is using the sheep for himself. Do you see how this works, right? Yes or yes?
Yes.
Yes. And this is exactly what the ancient mythologies and the pagan religions believed about the relationship between the gods and humanity. That the gods needed humanity. That they were fed off of the prayers and the devotion of humanity. This is the ancient Greco-Roman pantheon, that the gods and humanity were in this antagonistic, rivalristic relationship where, like, they would inflict punishment in order to get prayer and praise to fuel their divinity. It was an antagonism. It was an antagonism. But Jesus completely inverts this. He completely reverses what we should expect. He says, no, the good shepherd, what does he do? He lays down his life for the sheep. It's a complete interruption of the food chain. This is not how it's supposed to work, right? In the food chain, the little fish gets eaten by the bigger fish eats the bigger fish, right? That's how it works. In Christianity, Jesus is saying, I, as the biggest fish, exist to feed the littlest fish. It's a complete inversion. The good shepherd lays down his life, serves the life of the sheep. I'm not here to take your life. I'm here to give you my life. That's the good shepherd. I'm not here to take life from you. Because again, John 10:10, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. I'm not here to take life from you. I'm here to lay down my life for you. And if you're married, which you all are because you're here, that should sound awfully familiar. That should sound awfully familiar. Because once upon a time, God brought someone into your life that wasn't there before. There was a person who showed up on the horizon of your experience, and this person, whether in an instant or over a gradual period of time, this person made such an impact in your heart that this person, like, pierced you with the beauty of who they were. You were captivated by this person. Your heart became defenseless before this person. And all of that, it moved you to do something really wild and really stupid. Which is to say, I'm going to surrender my life to you. I'm going to surrender my life to you. I'm going to lay down my life for you. And you did upon the altar of sacrifice. You said, I'm not here to take life from you. I'm here to give you my life. Like, what got you to the altar on the day of your wedding was that the Sacred Heart of Jesus, it's like Jesus threw a spark of his own divine love into your hearts that you've tasted. The very love that animates, that moves the sun, the moon, and the stars. Like, you've had a very small taste of his love. That's what got you to the altar on your wedding day. That's why any heart that falls in love, eventually you get to a point where you say, all I want to do is lay down my life for you. Which is another way of saying, is all I want to do is get on a cross for you. That's why you get married in a church. And this love that you've tasted, this love that's been shared with you, that's brought you to this vocation of marriage, it's like, what is his love like? It's wild. Let's start with that. It's wild. And it's trusting. And it's vulnerable. And it's willing to take the risk. Jesus is the most vulnerable. He's the most vulnerable. You know, vulnerable, the word comes from the Latin vulnus, which means wound or woundable. To be vulnerable is to take the risk of willing to be wounded, willing to be hurt. And he goes first in it. Like, he's utterly obliterated on the cross. He's stripped completely naked, and his body is just, he looks like human roadkill on the cross, pinned outside the city of Jerusalem. Utterly defenseless. And even at the culmination of his life, he's hanging on the cross in death. The soldier pierces his heart with the lance, as if God was saying, this isn't even far enough. I want to give you access to the innermost recesses of my heart. Like, every wall is torn down. He gives us total access. And when he shows up to Thomas, what does he say to Thomas? Whatever you need, Thomas, here's my hands. Touch the wounds. Like, he shows him his wounds. He says, here's the wound in my side. Have you ever seen that image, the painting of Caravaggio, the image of the incredulity of doubting Thomas, which, you know, if a painting could have, like, sound effects, you know, you see Thomas there, Jesus is guiding his hand into his side, right? It's very visceral. It's very scandalous in the Middle Ages. Like, Thomas is just going, like, he's just, like, about to hurl because he's like, I'm putting my hand in his side. But, like, pause there. Think about that. Saying, I'm even giving you access to the innermost recesses of my heart. This is the wild, vulnerable, risky love of our Jesus. When you got married, you said those vows to each other. You said those words. We're going to renew the vows here after this homily. And what you're essentially saying to each other on the day in that Mass is, I'm not going anywhere. I'm all in. Come what may. And because of that, you can trust me. You can let me in. You can let the defenses down. And you only did that because of love. What often happens, because we live in a fallen world, because we do a really good job of ignoring our hearts and running from our hearts, what often happens is that as we live our lives, and as hurts happen within relationships, as they happen within marriage, or as things get ignored or swept under the rug, resentment builds. And what each of you begins to do is you begin to build walls and fortify your own hearts with defenses. You leave the posture of saying, I want to let you into everything. And you begin to start saying things like, there's stuff I have to protect myself from. There's stuff I can't let you into. You start holding back a bit here and there, guarding yourself a bit, and you no longer are really letting yourself be seen and really letting yourself be known. And eventually the vows, which started off as, I'm not going anywhere, I'm all in, come what may, those vows, those words eventually turn into, you're not going anywhere, so I don't have to do much anymore. And you stop running after each other. You stop pursuing each other. And the pain builds, and the walls build, and the defenses get more and more fortified. And friends, look, if that is resonating with you at all right now, like, hear me, there's no condemnation. Like, this is an invitation from the heart of the bridegroom, from the heart of our God, who is a good shepherd. Like, you're here by God's grace, and maybe you're here just to hear this, I don't know. To be reminded that, like, healing can really happen. Like, hurts can really be mended. Like, it's possible to be vulnerable. Real intimacy is possible, only if we're willing to take the risk. And I know it's hard. I know it can be hard. But healing is on the other side. The greatest things in life are always on the other side of the greatest vulnerability. Like, the dragon that guards the greatest treasure is vulnerability. If you want the most beautiful things, you have to be vulnerable. You have to let your heart be like his heart, which is to say wild and trusting and vulnerable and willing to take the risk. Like, what I would beg of you, what I would beg all of you to do is to really allow, ask the Lord for the grace again to be overwhelmed. Like, be overwhelmed by his love. Like, Jesus' love gets so reduced to like Hallmark platitudes that we all just know. Like, do you know that he sees you? Like, you're the one he went after. Like, Luke 15, Jesus gives us another understanding of what it means that he's the good shepherd. He says, who among you, addressing the Pharisees, who among you, having 100 sheep and losing one, would go after, leave the 99 and then go after the one? Do you know the answer to that question? None of them would. Because that's idiotic. Because in my world, a 99% is an A+ every day of the week. And if you're a shepherd, one lost sheep, fine, I got 99. There was something wrong with that one anyway, I bet. Right? But here's how Jesus' math works. One lost sheep is one lost sheep too many. And here's another secret I'll let you into. There is no such thing as the 99. We're all the one. We are all the one. There's not like good, well-behaving sheep and then us. We're just all the one. He only ever sees the one. Like right now in this Mass, when he becomes present on this altar, he's coming here for you, for the one. That's it. Like, be overwhelmed by that. That the God of the universe bankrupts heaven for you. He took the risk for you. He descended into hell for you. He rose from the dead for you. He waits like a prisoner of love in every tabernacle for you. At the end of every day, he's not thinking, well, yeah, that was great. I got to see, you know, this person, this person, this person, and maybe she'll come back here tomorrow. He's waiting for you because you're the one. It's always about the one. Friends, let us be overwhelmed by the love of Jesus pursuing every part of our hearts, that we would be so inflamed again to pursue each other. I don't care if you've been married 5 minutes or 55 years. He's inviting you to be the good shepherd unto each other, to pursue each other, to find the little lost sheep in each other. Because you are the one that the one gave you. Amen.